Accession number 31559, reel 3.
It was a stretch of field on the left-hand side as I left Hatfield proper. And I saw a man in the distance walking at a tremendous rate. He was going to come across and get to the path which was beside the road I was on. I happened to notice him. He was going at such a rate and sort of doing this. And to my horror, he didn't stop on the edge of the green. He shot straight across the road in front of me. And got, he slid up onto the bonnet. And I was horrified because he just came out of the blue. Well, I thought, oh God, this is awful. And the most extraordinary thing, that a physiotherapist in her car happened to pass me the other way going into Hatfield, and she stopped, thank goodness, because she saw the incident. She saw what happened and how he just shot right across. And because I was really worried. Anyway, she said that she would... there'd obviously be a case because he was killed. And I will, you can use me as a witness because I saw what happened and I saw what was going to happen. And anyway, it was very worrying. And I saw a partner of them, what do you call it? The people who will speak for you at what's they called? At
the inquest?
Yes, that's right. And she was working for me, this person anyway, and she asked me several questions and so on, and said this, that, and the other, and this girl had given her name and her address and everything, and there was a short case about it, but it didn't have a hitch. It was, and apparently the locals knew this man. He was a bit sort of curious or something, but it was a horrid incident. Very worrying, very, you know, you tend to think it must be your fault. But it wasn't extraordinary that a physiotherapist should come by. I never knew quite what she was doing, but she didn't live in Hatfield, she lived further up, but there was this particular road, she came probably every day.
What sort of time of day was this?
Mm-hmm.
What sort of time of day did
this
happen?
Oh, yes. Well, it was light. I think if I went to home for the weekend, I usually went on Friday night, I think. Could have been Saturday. I can't remember. But it was, it'd be Friday night. No, wait a minute, it'd be Saturday. I think we had a physiotherapy department on Saturday morning. So it would be the afternoon, I think, yes. Afternoon of Saturday. And I came back Sunday night. Don't know why I told you about that.
What sort of rate of success did the nerve sheath operation have?
Yeah, with a surprisingly good result. And as it grew, they would, for instance. There's a median nerve and an ulnar nerve, and you gradually see a little flicker, and you tell the patient that's such and such a nerve coming back, is growing, and sometimes Professor Seddon used what you call it, when you break your arm, you have it encased in what's it called?
Plaster cast?
Yes, that's right, plaster cast. Sometimes he would bring it so far and allow the fingers to come out, and it would go so far, all depending where the nerve was severed or injured. And they could start movements then, and then the cast would be taken off, and they gradually, they were amazed actually how they were able to use their hand again, yes, or their legs. The legs were, it was more tricky with the hands because there were more delicate movements you need and so on, and the nerves go up to each finger. So, with the leg, it was rather extraordinary that I should have gone there, because my husband had this gunshot wound here, you see, in here, and he was sent down to South Africa after his plaster was put on, etc., and it was too late to do anything. In any case, I don't think this treatment was available there. In fact, certainly wasn't. And then eventually he was shipped back when he was well enough to Britain. And but it was extraordinary that he should have the sort of injury that the people who came to Ripon Hall could recover from. But it, of course, does depend to what extent the injury has affected the tissue around and the fibula or tibia, fibula at the side and tibia. But he doesn't, we're indoors now, he just wears, he sometimes, he gets used to lifting his knee up a bit, but it's amazing how little he allows it to interfere with it. Because when he goes out, he wears this plaster that goes down and under the foot there. He doesn't think anything of it at all. But at one time, they had a very clumsy arrangement to allow him to use his shoe. And I remember that when we were getting it repaired, he had to, that I said, I can't understand why they don't do something better than this. And I spoke to the office that I took it to, and I said, I wonder that there isn't an improvement on this. And he said, well, as a matter of fact, there is. And we got it. So it was much more convenient and much more comfortable.
What sort of time would it take for the nerves to recover?
Ah, I think I did know exactly. It would take quite a long time. All depending. I don't remember. It's an interesting question. Very interesting question. I ought to remember that, shouldn't I? It's such a long time ago. Isn't that awful? I must see if I can't look it up. Because when we were married and when we had three children. he was a king's, and he put in for another job, and this one rather appealed to him in the Sudan, Khartoum, and partly because his interests were in these little animals, if you like, who come up from the soil and so on. And he thought that it would be the right climate for him to be able to follow up what he was interested in and actually see it locally or go out. And so in the end he did apply for it and got it. Of course it did mean a bit of a wrench because the boys were at day school doing quite well. But Peter came up with us though. He went to Dulwich. All three of them then eventually went to Dulwich. And two of them went to Cambridge. But out there, I was, when they knew that I was a physiotherapist, they said, "Oh, will you start a physiotherapy department in Omdurman?" And Omdurman was, I expect you to know of Omdurman because it was very well known as the largest town or village, if you like, in the Sudan that was made of mud bricks. And it was very interesting because mud brick houses are much cooler than a house built with ordinary bricks. And then they had a thatch, I think. And it grew and was a very big. You almost call it a city. It was just across the Blue Nile from Khartoum. And they had physiotherapists, of course, in Khartoum, at the Khartoum hospital, which was quite a big hospital. But they had opened a department, quite a big department, with an orderly that had a training in Khartoum, and he had a radiant heat bath, and he would treat the children with infantile paralysis, and he'd massage them like this, marvelous. But I mean, it did them some good. he was quite a character, Mahmoud. And anyway, when I got down there, I was very interested. A very nice, large space we were given, and with plinths and radiant heat bars. And I was able to, through the headquarters to order apparatus like they had in Khartoum. So we were very well furnished by the time I got that. And there was a British trained medical who was in charge, and one or two others too, and also some Sudanese who were trained in Britain, and so I found that very interesting, and I got to know the women who came to the department with their children or with them or whatever. And And I spoke, Arabic. How do you refer to it when you... colloquial Arabic, that's right. And gradually, Mahmoud spoke so fast, I thought I'd never understand what he said. But he was a character. Anyway, he was very nice and cooperative. He had a motor bicycle. And sometimes I would see him go off, and he had, they wear these emmas once they leave the department, well, in the department for that matter. And once I remember looking out the gate, I was just going to my Land Rover, which was inside the hospital grounds. I saw him on his bicycle shooting along the road here, and his emma was coming undone and was trailing up behind him. Marvellous, so just like him in his his character. He was a very nice fellow. And was very helpful and respectful, very nice. And anyway, it became quite a department, and patients didn't have to go to Khartoum if they needed treatment, which pleased them because they lived in Khartoum and so on. They lived in Omdurman. And then I got to know the women and went to their homes. They asked me to come and have, after the department was finished, about 6 o'clock. And they, nearly all the houses had a sort of yard out the back, and you'd come into the house that way perhaps, and there might be a tree, either their tree or the next door neighbour's tree, and come in about, when the apartment's finished, about 6, and you know, it was quite hot and nice and very relaxing, and they would make coffee, and it was a wonderful smell because they did it from scratch, and the coffee grounds, and they would pound, and you would hear the pounding, and then you would smell the coffee, and then they'd make the coffee, and then they'd put them in wonderful little cups, and bring it out, and most of them had some a tree with the leaves on or something, and it was a wonderful atmosphere. It was just cool, and the smell of the coffee, and after doing a day's work, you know, and they were so friendly and nice, and the, perhaps they would have a relation there and children, and I got to know them very well. Two families in particular. One was Mahmoud's family, of course, his wife, and another one was another wife of his, which he had to marry because he really only wanted to marry the one, fortunately, but anyway, he apparently carried on with this other lady. She was a bit more severe looking too, so I was surprised, but probably his wife was having a baby or something. And the family got to know of it, and they said that he must marry her. So he did, and he would go and see her so often. And anyway, she asked me too. So these two, they were quite different families, behaved quite differently. His wife was very easygoing and gentle and relaxed. And she asked me once, "Do you love your husband?" And so I said, "Oh, yes, yes, I do. Why don't you?" "No," she said. Because he was, apparently she told me, that she only spoke Arabic, of course, but she told me that her father wanted her to marry Mahmoud because he had a decent job and quite well paid. And so she more or less had to marry him. But they were on good terms. But the other one was a bit more severe looking. She always wanted a baby, but fortunately for Mahmood, she never did have one. But every now and again, he would come to me in the department and say, what's her name now? God, I can't remember her name. I wrote a book called Women of Armed Men, and I'd bring them into it. And she what was I saying? That's right. The woman who was we had to marry was she had what was called a Tsar ceremony. I don't know if you've heard of it. Called a Tsar ceremony. It's still going on now, and it's very complicated. The idea is that the Tsar ceremony is a very old custom amongst most of the Sudanese, I think, but if you want a Tsar ceremony, if a wife wants a Tsar ceremony, she has to ask her husband for some money, and if he doesn't give it, it looks very bad to the community. So they more or less have to, because they'd be looked down upon, you know, if they didn't. And because that wife wanted a dress or something or other, so that's the story. And they use a shaker. It's a sheikh, but it's a woman, so she's called a shaker. And she has her drum, and also coffee and various things. A little pot with charcoal in it, where you burnt henna. And these are all the necessary things that went with the Tsar ceremony. And she would use a cover. I think I've got it out here. Do you see that cover? Yes, that's right. Do you see that? Looks like a large sort of summer hat, I suppose. It's called God, what's it called? A tisht, I think. Probably, I don't remember. And she and there's a they put a handle on the inside so they could hold it up as though it was a shield. And a Tsar ceremony, the wife has to ask a shaker, that is someone who runs a Tsar ceremony, and there are several in Khartoum in on demand, and the woman would choose someone that was she was au fait with or liked. And I got several of my pictures of them, and I ought to show them to you. I'd love to show them to you. And she had this diluka, which she beat a certain drum, certain tunes on it, associated with the Tsar ceremony. And she had this shield up in her hand like this, and a drumstick in her other hand. That's the sort of, you know, how they stop the ceremony. And they asked me to come and witness one. You see, it was very interesting indeed. And the woman who asked for it, she would dance certain sort of dances, and she would have to have a dress for this, you see. Once she had this dress as a result of having a Tsar ceremony, which her husband would be bound to give her, she would then have it, because she wanted one anyway. And if she'd asked for it for him, probably he would say, no, I haven't got enough money or something. But if she had a Tsar ceremony, he'd have to give it to her.
What was the purpose of the ceremony?
Well, it was really, well, it was twofold, I suppose. One, the husband had to give money. She could buy a clear new dress. And the women get together and have sort of coffee parties. And they show off to each other, really, like we do, I suppose, up to a point, rather similar in many ways. And so you said, what was the significance of it? Yeah, and also, the wife who got a tsar would ask friends, women, who she knew rather well, and it'd be a lovely occasion, you see. Sometimes it could go on for more than one day. I think it usually starts in the afternoon, but it can start in the morning. But it goes on all day, and you hear the drum. You know that it is a tsar ceremony. And because I remember when we came through the came through the from the coast when we came back to Khartoum one year in a German ridiculous car. I had to ask my husband about that, I keep forgetting. And we came through, and when we got to Muzawarat, which was after we'd come through where the souk lorries would come, no people at all, and they'd come through this, and we'd get to Muzawarat, and once I heard a tsar ceremony go on there, and I said, John, I must find out if there's a tsar ceremony. And so we stopped, and I asked the woman who was going in. She was amazed that I knew about a tsar ceremony. She was very taken aback, and she didn't sort of want to say it first, but anyway, I could speak, you know, broken Arabic, and she told me, yes, that it was a tsar, and she told me what it was for, but I can't remember now. I don't know if I put it in my book or not. But anyway, it was fascinating to hear the music, the same music that I hear in Omdurman, right in the desert area. Anyway, you said, well, what's it for? Yes, well, when the shaker drum a certain is a certain way, I think it's sort of liberating to the woman, because she can dance and comes up lifted, I suppose, and the other women who've been invited will sing, and they sit on mattresses which are arranged. It's quite a performance that they usually go in for to organize. They have these, they would take the mattress from off the angareeb, you know, an angareeb. It's a sort of bed which is made locally, and the mattress, as it were, is made of rope, sort of strung together, and they have a mattress on that. That those angareebs, as they're called, are there like our beds. They're nice and cool, and why did I mention the angareeb?
They were sitting on them.
Yeah, that's right, yes, yes. They took the mattresses and put them round the room, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and something, and then the women would sit on it, and I would too. And